We will pause for the Pledge of Allegiance. Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you for staff, petitioners, and members of the public who are participating. Our procedures will be as follows. The agenda is broken down into several parts. First, notices, proclamations, and acknowledgments. Next, the consent agenda, which consists of items for which the applicant is in agreement with the staff recommendation and there are no known objections. This will be followed by regular business, old business, and adjournment. For each agenda item on regular business, the staff will make a presentation. The staff presentation will then be followed by a presentation from the petitioner, should they elect to do so. The petitioner will be allotted a time frame of no more than 20 minutes. The board may then ask questions of the petitioner or staff for clarification. Afterwards, the floor will be open for public comment. If you wish to make a public comment today on the item that the board is considering at the time, members of the public that are in person must fill out a little blue card, like Sally's holding up right now, Ms. Helms is holding up, so you can make that public comment on that item. If you're participating virtually, use the raise your hand feature on your screen. Do not use the feature until the item you want to comment on is being considered. At the appropriate time, you will be recognized and staff will unmute your microphone. At the end of your allotted time, as determined by the chair, your microphone will be muted and the chair will recognize the next speaker. The total public time, comment time, will be less than or equivalent to the petitioner's presentation time. Therefore, for those participating online, it is important to use the raise your hand feature during the hearing on that item if you want to speak on a petition. Once the floor is closed for public comment on a petition, no additional public speakers will be allowed. If you are not certain you want to speak, still use the raise your hand feature, or if in person, fill out a blue card and you will be recognized. If you decide not to speak, you can withdraw your petition, your request. After public comment, the petitioner will have an opportunity for rebuttal and then address any additional needed questions by the board. Finally, the board will take action. And we're going to get started with an approval of the agenda.
Cole's motion approving the agenda.
Bull second.
All right. Voice vote, please. All in favor? Any opposed? Okay. We did have notices, proclamations, and acknowledgments. We did have a special called personnel committee meeting. And let me see if I can read this without getting my words backwards. We agreed today to create a committee to evaluate the form that we use for compensation, as well as the compensation processes, to make it easier for people in the future to or boards in the future to evaluate our fearless leader, the executive director. And Travis Coles is going to be chairing that committee for this evaluation. So just an FYI. All right. We did have several items requested to be removed from the final agenda. Site plan with a variance for 1001-1015 Whitaker and 124 West Park. Is there anyone here for that agenda item? All right. There's also a special use for 513 East Oglethorpe, Suite G. Is there anyone here for that item? A map amendment for Dean Forest and Ogeechee Road. Is there anyone here for that item?
That was the
I'm sorry. Which item are you here for?
Item number four.
Okay. We are not going to hear that today, so I don't have a date that it will be heard on, but if you'll go ahead.
I'll just say, I think the petitioner is fairly confident they'll move forward next NPC meeting.
Next meeting. All right. And item 5, site plan variance, Preston Drive and Point Grand. Anyone here for that item? All right. We do have several items that were requested to be withdrawn. Oh, yes, we do.
Cole's motion to remove items 2 through 5 from the final agenda.
Stephen's second.
All right. All in favor, voice vote.
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. Motion carries. The items requested to be withdrawn, site plan with a variance, 8608 Abercorn Street. Is there anyone here for that item?
Cole's motion to withdraw item 6.
Wait a minute. There's one. Oh, no, that is item 6. All right. Second?
Second.
All in favor, voice vote?
Aye.
Any opposed? On the consent agenda, we have the approval of the September 24, 2024 meeting minutes. We have a master plan amendment for 0 Little Neck Road. We have a site plan with variance for 0 William Street. Does anyone care to have those removed from the consent agenda? Is there anyone here to speak on those items? All right, motion.
Cole's motion to approve the consent agenda.
Full second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right. We have no old business, and our regular business, number 10, map amendment for 1105 East Anderson Street.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the board. This is Edward Morrow, Director of Development Services here at the MPC. Here to speak to you briefly about a rezoning request for 1105 East Anderson Street. You can see an aerial view of the subject property on your screen right now. The subject property is currently zoned TR2 or traditional residential 2, and the petitioner is requesting to rezone to TC1, which is traditional commercial 1. Just to show you the current situation for the future land use and zoning maps, subject property is indicated for traditional commercial use. And you can see that it is adjoining TC1 commercial off of Waters, but it is within the TR2 based on the zoning map here. There is one item I'd like to bring to your attention today, the subject property. Unfortunately, there was not a neighborhood meeting held only because we were not able to make contact with the listed point of contact for the Benjamin Van Clark Park Neighborhood Association. The petitioner did email the email address that was listed on Savannah Open Neighborhoods in an attempt to establish contact and appear at a meeting. That was unsuccessful. Also, MPC staff did attempt to call the phone number that was listed on the website, and it is inactive. So this map that you can see on your screen right now shows the properties that are within the notification boundary. They did all receive mailed notices. In looking at the Sanborn maps for the subject property, you can see historically dating back to at least 1916, there was a dwelling on the property. So no history of commercial use. However, again, the future land use map does indicate it for traditional commercial use. The photo below shows the residence that at one time was located on the property. You can see it's at the corner there of Waters and Anderson. With that, MPC staff does recommend approval, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right, thank you. Is the petitioner here?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am, Madam Chair. For the record, Josh Yellen representing Jessica Glenn of Anderson & Waters, LLC, who is the owner of this property. Edward kept it very short and sweet, so I will try to do the same, but we do thank staff for working with us on this application and for the recommendation of approval to rezone to TC1. As you could see on Edward's map, I'm not going to mess with his screen. Most of the lots that are commercial along the Waters Avenue corridor are a little bit deeper than what we have seen here. This site is under common ownership with the adjacent site that is directly on Waters. The intent is to redevelop the site and, as Edward mentioned, to potentially recombine for a use. The current plans would be for a limited upper story residential with ground floor Pilates studio and potentially a small coffee shop. As was mentioned, we reached out to the Benjamin Van Clark Neighborhood Association. I personally sent that email, did not receive a response. I know that the applicant also, after I sent that email, tried on her own to reach the Benjamin Van Clark Neighborhood Association. There was no response received. She additionally reached out to the Live Oak Neighborhood Association, even though we are not in that district. We also did not receive a response from them. So I do just want to make clear that we have done our best to conduct a neighborhood meeting to have the outreach. We are happy to keep trying if we're allowed to move forward to council, but we do want to thank staff for the recommendation of approval. I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have, but would hope that you vote to approve of the same. So thank you all.
Thank you. Are there any questions for the applicant or the staff? All right. I'll entertain a motion. Oh, I'm sorry. Is there anyone here to talk on this? Okay. I'll entertain a motion.
Cole's motion to approve staff's recommendation.
Cole, second.
All right. Ms. Amick, how do you vote?
Yes.
Ms. Bowles?
Yes.
Mr. Coles?
Yes.
Mr. Irvin? Oh, Mr. Irvin's not here. Mr. Melder?
Yes.
Ms. Wilson?
Yes.
Mr. Notrika?
Yes.
Mr. Plunk?
Yes.
Mr. Stevens?
Yes.
Mr. Welsh?
Yes.
Mr. Wywoody?
Yes.
All right, I too say yes. Motion passes. Our next item is a site plan variance, 1100 East 31st Street.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board. Again, this is Edward Morrow. And so this is a request, a parcel that came before you previously in May as a request for rezoning similar to that we just heard from TR to TC. It is located at the intersection of 31st and Waters, and this is just to the south of the subject parcel from the previous request. And so now that this parcel was rezoned to TC, the petitioner has returned with a request for two site plan variances. The first for allowance of four-story construction, where there is a maximum of three up to 45 feet, and the second for a reduced modified use buffer, where a multifamily dwelling would adjoin a duplex, either a one-family or two-family. They are asking for a reduction of that use buffer that would adjoin those two. So just to show you the future land use map, you can see that it is currently situated for TC and also zoned TC1. Again, here's that history. This was approved for rezoning on June 27th, 2024 by council. And though at the time this came before you, there was not a specific concept that was proposed, in subsequent meetings, the petitioner did share with members of the community, elected officials, the concept that you'll see in just a moment. Staff was not aware of the specific nature of it, but we knew that it was a proposed four-story apartment building. And so this present request is in keeping with that. This is something that we have seen before, but again, you are being requested today to evaluate something that was somewhat known during the rezoning process, though it now requires a separate variance. So again, you can see the 1916 Sanborn map here showing there's a history of mixed use on the parcel, commercial on the ground floor and upper story residential. The structure that was there for many years was demolished in 2023. And so here is a conceptual rendering of the four-story apartment building that is proposed at the site. Per the petitioner, there are a proposed 12 apartment units that would go in this building. You'd have ground floor parking with four units on each of the three floors up top. And so that fourth floor would not be permitted within the TC zoning district. And so the first request is to allow a fourth story within the context of the 45-foot height limitation of the zoning district. I'll also note that as this went through City Council, there was a condition that was attached, again, with foreknowledge of this concept that's coming before you today, that there would be one affordable housing unit to be provided within this project. This is the ground floor plan conceptually. You can see this is where you will have your parking stalls. There are 10 car spaces proposed, 2 motorcycles and 8 bicycles. And then this is a typical residential configuration. Again, it's our understanding that the applicant intends to include 12 dwelling units, 4 on each floor. So there's one significant fact here in consideration of the second variance, which is that modified buffer. There is an encroaching structure that is on the adjoining parcel. And you can see in this red box, this actually is the location of that encroachment. And so the requested modified buffer plan takes into account this encroaching structure, which is pre-existing. The petitioner would like to design around it. And so if you were looking down at the proposed building, and this is the existing structure that encroaches, you can see that there's a non-uniform buffer here where the cars are intended to park. There's a series of plantings as well as a fence that is proposed within this space. Just to show, this is the side of the non-conforming, non-residential structure that is pre-existing on the parcel that immediately adjoins the proposed construction. And if you were standing between the two, this is kind of what you would see. Just to share with you, this is the modified buffer plan that staff is referencing in the conditions. We are recommending approval of both variances, the first to permit the 4-story construction in accordance with the buffer plan that you see here in condition 2, on the condition that the one of the 3-bedroom apartments be the affordable dwelling that was approved by City Council at the time of the rezoning. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
All right, thank you. Is the applicant available?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Robert McCorkle, firm McCorkle, Johnson, McCoy here on behalf of the petitioner. As was mentioned by staff, property is located on the corner of Waters and 31st Street. We've got 100 foot of frontage on Waters and 60 feet on the 31st, we were here before you in May for the rezoning of this property to TC1 for the purposes of building a multifamily project on the site. At the time, we were working on the site and what it was going to look like as we came through MPC. By the time we got to council, both meeting with the applicable aldermen as well as the neighborhood, we showed plans of the project and what we intended to build. This is, and I'm going to show you a bunch of pictures to give some context as to why we're asking for the variances, but this is the building that was on the property prior to the rezoning of the property and prior to it being removed in 2023. It was commercial on the bottom and residential on the top, multifamily on the top, and it was zero lot line, as you can see here, to the back of the building. The rear portion of the lot was zero lot line. The new building, as was shown to you earlier, that we're proposing to build is 4 stories in height. We are not asking for additional height. We're just asking for an additional story. But the building is actually a mass timber structure that will be built on top of a pedestal. Mass timber is a sustainable, low-carbon building alternative to concrete and steel. There's one other project that we're aware of in Savannah that exists that was mass timber construction as well. It's post and beam construction. It's really interesting. It's actually constructed off-site and then will be erected on site, and it saves an incredible amount of time on the construction process and will actually take about 4 days to build the mass of the structure on the site once it is brought here. Previously constructed, already fitted out for electrical and plumbing, et cetera. This type of construction allows a lot of the wood to be exposed, allows for different beautiful types of buildings that are architecturally interesting compared to the way some others may look. We think it's an exciting addition to the Waters corridor. There's been a lot of discussion over the years about needing revitalization in this Waters corridor. I think there were probably 10 plus letters of support provided in connection with the project. If you read any of them, you know, common comments were that this is feeding a need for revitalization in the area. There's a need for additional residents to be in walking distance of the businesses that are in the area, and there is a need for for residential units in the area, period. We're excited to see the project that's happening right behind us, which you just heard about before, which will be another addition on the corner going down Waters Avenue. This is the project that we showed to council when we came through for zoning. It is the project that we showed to the neighborhood when we came through. None of that plan has changed. We are just here today to ask for the two variances that are required in order to make it happen. In connection with the zoning, council did ask us to provide one affordable unit on the property, which we agreed to do. The two variances that we're seeking today, one is for an additional story and one is for reduction of the buffer. With regard to the four-story, again, we're not asking for any additional height. We'll be within the 45-foot limit. The four-story allows us to park the project on the bottom floor. That's the real gist of what we're doing. Part of the discussion that we had through the rezoning process with the neighborhood was the concern to make sure that we were parking the project per the ordinance, which we are going to do, which is why we're asking for the addition of the 4-4 within the 45 feet. We believe this is consistent with other large-scale projects that are coming down Waters Avenue. This is our project here in the background right here. There's an empty lot, obviously, but this is the site behind us, which is the last item on the agenda. This is looking down from Henry Street. You've got the Ramona Riley project on the left. You've got a building that's been there for a long time, a large-scale apartment building on the right. And so looking at the massing models of our building, as you come down Waters towards Henry, we believe that we're consistent with kind of size and scale of those buildings. And so with this request today, we are just asking for this additional story to allow us, again, to park the site on the bottom floor with as under a pedestal and then have the building constructed on top with 12 units, as was mentioned by staff. The second request is a reduction in the buffer. I actually wasn't aware that this buffer requirement existed in the ordinance. When we got a call from staff about it, when we originally were applying for this, we weren't applying for a buffer variance because I didn't know it existed. I haven't actually ever had a project where this has been applied to, and had a conversation with the Yellens about this as well, who have not had this issue come up in a project that they've been involved with. And so this was a bit of an educational experience for us. When we originally applied for the variance, we asked for it to just be removed. And our argument was this variance doesn't exist to our knowledge anywhere around us or anywhere near us. And so we just asked for it to be waived. Staff raised some concerns with us about waiving it completely. And so we went back to the drawing board to try to come up with a plan, a modified plan that would allow us to build the project and still provide some amount of buffer that exists. We believe that what we're proposing, the requested buffer that we're proposing, is more than adequate and that it meets the criteria for the variance that y'all have before you. One of those criteria is whether literal application of the ordinance would deprive us of rights that are commonly enjoyed by other property owners. In the Waters Avenue corridor coming from Victory towards Henry, almost every single property in that corridor is already zoned T1 or TC1. They're all mixed-use commercial properties. In the future land use map, they're all shown as commercial. So every single one of those properties would all have a buffer requirement applied to them today per the ordinance that was adopted in NUSA. Most of those properties are already commercial and mixed use. If you look, this is just for some flavor, coming down Waters as you're headed toward our project up here on the right, you've got Brady Electric and buildings on the right, and then you kind of have a series of commercial buildings that have been there for quite some time, obviously well before NUSA, and you've got auto repair stores and some small shopping centers. You'll see here, this is the auto repair store. There's no buffering historically between these commercial buildings that existed and the residences and duplexes that are next to them. This is a newer construction project. This is a commercial site. I think it's a wing place that also here you can see there's a fence between them and the single family residence next door. But again, there's no buffer constructed on the site. This is a small little center that's there, two blocks from us or one block from us, really. You can see here, this is actually the current color of it in the backside of the building. Again, historically, no buffer at all, virtually built zero lot line, with additional properties. This condition doesn't just exist for the commercial buildings that go up and down Waters that are in commercial zones. It also exists for the other residential buildings that are surrounding us. This is just a few pictures of existing buildings that are on our street. So this is directly across the street from us. You can see that the residences and the duplexes are built very close to each other. There is an actual interior side yard setback in the district now that's 10 feet, but that doesn't apply to these houses, which predated the ordinance. But I'm just giving it to give context again. The context in the area is buildings that are very close to each other, ease almost touching, no buffers that exist, even in new construction houses that are constructed in the area. Everything is pretty close. This is actually the project behind us that was on the agenda before us. You can see here, again, a residential structure next to a traditionally commercial structure that has no buffer and no setback at all. It's basically zero lot line. In addition to the residential buildings that are around us, there are some apartments and some condo projects that have been built in recent years, some not in as many recent years, that are in the general area, not immediately adjacent to us necessarily, but in the area. This is the Presida condo project, which is over next to Hopatomica, if you're familiar with this very large-scale condominium building project. This was done in a PUD, so again, I'm not taking the position that the buffer, as it applies to us, exactly would apply to them. I just want to provide some context here. The next to a vacant single-family residential lot here, there's no buffer provided. There's a fence, but there's no buffer provided next to this large-scale building. This is the building that's across the street from Hopatomica, which also doesn't have an actual buffer, although somebody has planted some bamboo in between that and the duplex this immediately next door. This is the building on the corner behind us on Waters that has been there forever, next to a single-family residence. Here again, there's no buffer. The buildings have a little bit of a setback, but no buffer there other than a fence. This is the Ramona Riley project, which is behind us. I worked some on that project, and we were working on parking variances for that project due to the affordability component that was involved. And so I'm fairly familiar with this project. But here you've got a property that's in TC1, which is in the same zone that we are in. And they have a multifamily apartment project, obviously, and this is a parking lot piece that's here. They are adjacent to a duplex building next door to them. And you can see here, again, there is no buffer between them. I think parking lots are required under the current buffer ordinance. Actually, it's a Class C buffer, which requires 20 to 25 feet of planted buffer in between a parking lot and an adjacent residence. So that would normally apply here, but you can see here it does not. Same standard here. This is actually across the street from us on Waters. This is the ancillary parking lot for the Ramona Riley project. Here again, it's a parking lot immediately adjacent to a duplex, which would require a Class C 20 to 25 foot buffer. You can see here there is no buffer. No buffer was required of them in putting this parking lot here, and it doesn't exist. And it's possible that I can't remember, frankly, whether that went through before NUZO or not. But either way, again, I just want to provide context that these buffers, they just don't exist in the area anywhere around us as far as I'm aware. And so what we're asking to do with this modified plan is to reduce that buffer in a manner that allows us to build a project. There's really only one property that's affected by this at the end of the day, which is the neighboring property. This is a picture of the neighboring property as it currently exists. You can see our sign out there. This rear building is not inhabitable. It cannot be resided in. We confirmed this with the city. The way this ended up looking like this is an interesting thing. There used to be one solid building all the way across the back of the property that was commercial in nature. And the city condemned the property on our property, which was when it was owned by a previous owner. They actually tore down the building in the back and left the remainder there. And so the owner of the adjacent property came in and added windows and a door that actually opened onto our property. It's encroaches onto our property by 2 or 3 feet the way that it was finished out. In addition to that, a door was added that opens onto our property. There are no rights to come onto our property or to even get in and out of that door. So there are no easement. There are no easements in place there, but the property does actually encroach. This is a rental duplex, which is in the front portion of the property, which again has a door back here in the rear, and is basically built zero lot line. This is the other side of that building in the back, just to show you. It's also basically zero lot line on the property adjacent. The neighboring property has a fence built up to the door there, so you can't actually access that door either. I think it's also built partially in a lane in the back. And so what we are proposing, we have a 10-foot setback for our building, which we're meeting. So what we're proposing is to put a buffer in a space that ranges from 7 feet down to 1 or 2 feet down the length of our building, along with a fence adjacent to our neighbor. You know, we don't feel that the neighboring property necessarily should have an expectation of a buffer. The building that was there historically was zero lot line in the rear and connected to the building. There was no buffer. That neighboring property is built within the setback that would be applicable. It's essentially zero lot line to our property. And so, frankly, we believe that any buffer that we're able to put in place, we believe will be better than what was there previously and certainly be an improvement. This is the picture of the buffer that staff showed. This is what we're proposing. Again, it'll be wider here in the front. It'll narrow down at places in the back. This plan may change a little bit potentially, but it would only expand. We may try to, you know, move things around in a way, but this is the proposal as it stands now. We would certainly do this as the minimum that would be required to us, along with the construction of a fence with this landscape buffer. As far as the hardship to us, one thing I want to note about this buffer requirement as it exists in the current ordinance, it applies to a piece of property based on the uses. It is not taking into consideration the size of the property or the location of the property, where it is in the city. Other than a couple of areas where that are exempt, this would apply anywhere essentially in the city. So it doesn't matter whether your property is 50 acres and has 200 unit apartments on it, or whether it's 0.15 acres and has 12 unit apartments on it. The buffer width is the same. And so on our property, 15-foot buffer, which is what the zoning ordinance provides for, would remove 25% of the total area of our lot, which is a huge number. I mean, that is a very large number. It's actually wider than the building setback that's required. And so we do believe that given the context of the neighborhood and given that none of these buffers exist around us or have been applied to other projects around us, and given just the nature of the urban design and nature of our neighborhood that we are in and how close these buildings are together, we think that any buffer we apply is a benefit. We think that this is going to be more than has been applied in any other project anywhere around us. And we support staff's recommendation for approval. Staff added an additional requirement that our one affordable unit be a three-bedroom unit. That's fine. We'll work with that with the city as we go through the process to get that done. And with that, we support staff's recommendation for approval, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you've got.
All right. Are there any questions for the applicant or staff? Okay. I have one question.
Yes, ma'am.
Access to that building. Hmm. How can that building be accessed?
It can be accessed down the entire other length of the building, which is in the backyard of our neighboring property. I'm not sure why the neighbor chose to put the door on our property, but
I understand.
They chose to do it. It was done, my understanding from the city, is that building was completed and finished without a permit. We didn't even have notice that it was happening at the time when it happened. And so, again, I'm not sure why you would put a door on someone else's property. I suspect that the thing they need to do is move it around to their building so that it's in their backyard and not in our yard.
I understand. It's more a life safety issue. You know, if something happens with that building, how are the fire department going to get in to eliminate whatever hazard there is?
Right. I mean, our building will meet the setback requirement, which is 10 feet, regardless of what happens with the buffer. So there will be some space there. We're certainly willing to have a conversation with the neighbor. I actually spoke to the neighbor, who I understand is here today. I spoke to the neighbor before we came here to talk about whether or not there was a desire to have some access, and we can discuss what we could do to the buffer to make it more palatable, and they weren't interested in having that conversation. So.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Okay.
Thank you.
I do have one speaker card, Jackie Zhao. Jackie Zhao. Please state your name for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Jackie Zhao. I'm owner of the property at 1106 East 31st Street. The property, which our property directly next to the project's proposed apartment development. I'm here today to voice my concerns regarding the variety that, you know, being considered for the project. First of all, the buffers, actually, as you know, buffer is really, it's a barrier. It's good for, you know, reducing the, you know, the noise and privacy, and I think this is very important. I mean, to put that huge building right next to us. I mean, it is, it will affecting a lot of things, you know, not talking about, will be impacted parking issues. As you see right now, on the street, we don't, it's already pretty, you know, busy impact on the street as well, parking issues. So, so I'm here just, to make sure that 15 feet buffer we need for our, for, especially for my buildings, it actually directly, the project directly impact to our buildings. So, the applicant say earlier that, when the backside of the building teared down, we basically just repairing it. We do have a permit to do that, to finish up just whatever they, when the city teared it down, we basically just repaired it and we put up there. I mean, that's not too many things we can do. I will, so I understanding that need for development and growth, but it must be done in a way consider the well-being current resident. I'm urging the committee to reconsider the variant and to find a solution that maintain the buffers, address the parking concerns, and reduce the impact on the sunlight neighborhood, labor homes. That's our concern. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Is there any questions for the citizen? All right. Thank you.
Thanks.
Now I also have online Catherine Schuff. Schuff. Go ahead.
Sorry, I was still muted. Hi. I am a resident living right around the corner on 32nd Street and an architect, and I agree with almost all of the comments from the letters of support. I'm in favor of development on Waters and providing additional housing, especially affordable housing, but I don't support the variance for the number of stories allowed. The buildings that the applicant showed on Anderson Street are some of the only three-story buildings in the area, and the vast majority of the properties nearby are one- and two-story homes and businesses. Also, the large building across 31st Street that they showed on the 3D view doesn't exist. So I'm not sure where that came from, but it's currently a vacant lot. And while the renderings shown are a very nice design, I don't really see an attempt to create something that's harmonious with the proportions of the surrounding buildings. And recognizing that they're keeping within the 45-foot height requirement, I do think that trying to fit four stories within that height and keep the building proportional with the context would be almost impossible. So I think a well-designed three-story apartment building could work in this location, but trying to cram four stories in there is just going to look out of place. Thanks.
Thank you. All right. Any questions for the citizen? All right. Go ahead, Mr.
Thank you. Just real quick. Just again, to clarify on the building in the back, it's not a residence. It's not occupiable. So it's a garage space is essentially what it is. It's a storage space in the back. There are certainly other alternatives for places that doors can be put. This issue would exist for them whether or not we had any variances or whether or not we were building any business over there whatsoever, because a fence could be built down the property line right now directly in front of the door. We can't help the fact that that's where it was put, but we do believe there are alternatives. We're certainly continue to be willing to have a conversation with our neighbor about how we can help provide that access and make that go easier for them. You know, again, the plan for this project has not changed. This is the plan that we showed to council and showed to the neighborhood. We received a lot of letters of support. I think that generally we have a significant amount of support for the project, and people are looking for revitalization in this area, which we hope to do. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Morrow, do we have letters in the packet of support?
Yes, ma'am. Combined support.
Okay.
There are 10 pages. I'm not sure if that equates to 10 letters, but it's 1, 2. Addressed to you. That's number 3 from Brianna Paxton. 4.
All right, thank you.
Seven letters.
Thank you. Any other questions, comments? I'll entertain a motion.
Motion to approve petitioner's request, Plunk.
Second.
All right, I have a motion and a second. Ms. Amick?
Real quick, that includes the two conditions, correct?
Yes.
Yes.
Ms. Bowles?
Yes.
Mr. Coles?
Yes.
Mr. Melder?
Yes.
Ms. Wilson?
Yes.
Mr. Nochica?
Yes.
Mr. Plunk?
Yes.
Mr. Stevens?
Yes.
Mr. Welsh?
Yes.
Mr. Wywoody?
Yes.
Right, I too say yes. Motion passes. All right, our next item is Master Plan Amendment 175 West Mulberry Boulevard.
Good afternoon, Madam Chairman, members of the Commission. My name is Brad Clement with Development Services staff here at the MPC. The petition is a request for an amendment to a master plan of what is known as the Mulberry at Godley. Godley being a larger master plan development, Mulberry represents a commercial pod within that master plan development. And so this amendment, because it's within the larger master plan, really only affects the Mulberry, but is in essence an update to the larger master plan that is Godley. And so when you look at the orientation slide here and you see just this small little piece, that doesn't really give you a scale of what we're talking about. This looks kind of like a hurricane map, represents all the pieces and parts that is Godley Station. So that's Godley Station North. That's the Highlands. This particular development, the Mulberry, is in what is known as Godley Station South. So it affects a lot of things because things like density measure and percentages of different uses are tracked across the entire master plan. And so over the weeks and months and meetings that we've had here, I know that we have talked about Godley Station many, many times where we're simply changing the colors on maps. But what we've never gone back to is the larger Godley Station master plan. We're dealing with the small pods tracks within that. This request affects only that, a single tract and the pod and the PUD. And so the question is, and this is the latest rendering of the most updated master plan of Godley Station, and this was actually provided by not this petitioner, but a petitioner that you'll meet in a subsequent meeting from the same firm that the agent for the petitioner represents. So they come back frequently and have a lot of interaction with Godley Station, not just this pod. But at some point in the future, we'll also be talking about the Mulberry again. So the information is available. You'll see the red, brown, orange part there adjacent to I-95. That is Godley Station South, and in particular, the Mulberry Pod. Notionally, the track that we're talking about is up at the northern end of that pod. And so sort of the microcosm, again, the progress of the Mulberry over the years. In 04, it sort of established and came outside of Godley with a more specific development plan standards. It was all commercial, and there were very specific uses tied to that commercial thing. This tract, which you'll see down here in 2024, was actually subdivided out in 2018, is a specific tract of the Mulberry that we're talking about. But we go from 2004, everything is orange. We amend that pod in 2012 and add this mustard yellow, which was multifamily residential, what had previously been designated for office use. In 2018, we add a little more mustard and then create this tract to the north that we're dealing with today, which remained commercial, but there were only four very specific uses tied to that tract: restaurant, bank, office, restaurant, bank, office, hotel. It could be commercial so long as it was one of those four flavors of development. The request today is to expand that, to get out from underneath the weight of those four uses, to incorporate all of the uses encompassed by the city's BC zoning district. And there's many, many more than just the four in the BC zoning. Here you go. Here's a bigger picture. And again, we're only talking about this tract, which is just about 14 acres. Godley Station is thousands of acres. Mulberry itself, I think, is only 82. Small piece of that. And this request only affects this tract again. So staff recommends approval. It is probably appropriate, given the number of years that this property has laid vacant, because you just can't seem to find a bank, hotel, office, or whatever that other thing I said goes there. It just, and you know, since it was created in 1996, nobody's been interested to pursue one of those four things on this particular tract. So this allows them the freedom to maybe seek out some other developers, and it's probably appropriate. We do apply some conditions to this. As I walked you down the lane of how we got here, staff believes it is appropriate now that we start taking a look at updating the larger Godley Station master plan, the document that we've gone back to and little, you know, fits and starts over the months and years previous. Staff is not unaware that may feel like we're charging the last guy through the door the bill for everybody who's been sitting at the bar for 20 years. But this particular firm and agency that we're dealing with has been responsible for many of the updates to many of the tracks within this. They have the data at their disposal to help us. And because we know that there are subsequent applications for future amendments to Godley Station that will be brought by this firm, this doesn't have to be a bill paid today, but over the next 3-4 subsequent applications, we will have a completer, tighter picture of what that master plan is. Also, with increasing the number of uses as prescribed in the BC zoning district, we're happy to support the expansion of uses, but with that, you get all the development standards and restrictions and special use limitations that go with those uses as applied to the PUD, because those are not in the PUD development standard, as those uses weren't accounted for in the original master plan. And of course, any future site plan based on plan development for some of those uses would have to come back. And if there are triggers there for traffic impact analysis or other things, that would be the time to add those measures, pending anyone's questions.
All right, is the applicant here?
Yes.
Good afternoon, John Giordano with Thomas & Hutton, and I guess we were the firm responsible for all of the condiments smeared all over the exhibit. So, we are here to request approval to amend the Mulberry Godley Station Master Plan to allow the uses under the Community Business Zoning District. Looking at the conditions of approval, we're good with that. I know we've had some conversations with Brad here recently about some of the other applications that have been submitted about updating the Godley Station master plan and making sure that those updated uses get reflected on that. So we're working through how we can go ahead and accommodate that and make sure that as each one of these amendments gets approved, we can go ahead and provide that updated document to the MPC and to the city so that that can be tracked in the future. So with that, if there's, excuse me, any questions?
All right. Are there any questions for the applicant?
This doesn't necessarily directly pertain to this, but the Benton Boulevard narrows to one lane pretty much past this commercial site until it gets to Jimmy DeLoach. Is there a timeline for finishing the widening from that point to Jimmy DeLoach?
That would be a question, I think, for the city. Sorry.
So, the Georgia Department of Transportation recently appropriated $13.5 million for the widening of Benton Boulevard to that point. City of Savannah also allocated $2.5 million towards that project. So the project is funded and being programmed as we speak.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I have something. I, too, am concerned about the traffic in this neighborhood. I hear people tell me about Benton Boulevard, and it is a little disconcerting, as well as an updated Godley Station master plan. Would an updated master traffic study be in order?
So the individual developments, as they come online, I guess if they triggered the city's requirement for a traffic study, would then necessitate that. But as it stands currently, I don't know that there's anything that necessarily requires a traffic update unless the proposed uses, which at this point, I'm not sure we know what those proposed uses might even be.
We have a traffic study when it was first proposed as a development back in 2004.
2018 was the last traffic study directly aimed at the Mulberry based on those uses. There was a determination that the expansion of uses of that single tract wouldn't warrant a deeper study. As far as a traffic analysis of all of Godley, I have not seen anything that would come close to that. I can't speak to that. What I'm saying is I have never seen one,
but
nor one referenced in any of the other historical documents.
Madam Chairwoman, if I could add, last year, the Georgia Department of Transportation released the Coastal Empire Transportation Study. Is that right, Ms. Wilson? And one of the key corridors focused in on that study was what they called the Effingham Parkway corridor, and it was broken into three sections. And the section that covered Benton Boulevard and Highlands Boulevard, Jimmy DeLoach, is what the Georgia Department of Transportation, I believe, referred to as the Effingham Parkway South corridor. There's some good data in terms of what they pulled together. So if you're looking for some state data in terms of traffic in that area, then I think that's a really good report to look at. Of course, GDOT's going to be focused mostly on freight traffic, but that is causing a lot of the traffic backup there in that area as well. But that's a good report to look at for this area.
There is a future application that was tied to a DRI, so there was a larger traffic study that will reflect some Benton Boulevard information as well. But again, to directly answer your question regarding a traffic impact for the, I don't even know how you would scope that. I don't.
Okay, so we have a road that basically has two ways in and two ways out, and we really, back in the day, we didn't bother to really look at what was going to happen when this area developed. Just a question.
Right, and as discussed, the development here on that particular tract is accessed by.
I understand this tract is very minor part of it all, but it's frustrating and difficult for me as a commissioner to know that we have a problem out there that's not easily solved. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. Any other comments? And I don't have any cards. No one wanted to speak on this. All right. Ready for motion?
Cole's motion to approve staff's recommendation with the three included conditions.
Plunk second.
All right. I have a motion and a second. Ms. Amick?
Yes.
Ms. Bowles?
Yes.
Mr. Coles?
Yes.
Mr. Melder?
Yes.
Ms. Wilson?
Yes.
Mr. Notrika?
Yes.
Mr. Plunk?
Yes.
Mr. Stevens? Oh, I'm sorry. Mr. Welsh?
Yes.
Mr. Wywoody?
Yes.
All right. I, too, will say yes. Motion passes. All right. Our last item is a text amendment, zoning ordinance, Section 3, alternative standards to Section 5, traditional neighborhood districts.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and the members of the board. I'm Subhashi Karunaratne, a planner from the MPC. I'll be presenting the staff report for a request to amend the zoning ordinance text to enable and regulate density increases for affordable housing in the TRT and NTC zoning districts. The petition includes specific amendments to these sections listed here, special exceptions, variances, principal use table, the traditional zoning districts, and residential use standards for limited and special uses. The changes proposed for the sections under Article 5 establishes a by-right standard for affordable housing, while the sections 3.12 and 3.21 and 8.1 creates a path to vary the standards under MPC version to allow for affordable housing. So if you take a look at the specifics of the proposed text, So under TR districts, the applicant proposes to include more housing types for affordable housing as limited uses, and it adds L for the use table and here. And also they define standards such as reduction of minimum lot area, lot width, increase of building coverage, and reduction of parking requirements, and specifies what housing types are allowed in the TR 1, 2, and 3, TN 1 and 2, and all TC districts. And next, if you look at the special exception path, in 3.21 and 3.12, the applicant is proposing additional review criteria that MPC may consider in the review process as public benefit, compatibility, reasonable use, and adequate public services. So it all comes together in one report. If you look at the background, why such a proposal is required or is proposed, according to the Housing Savannah Task Force, affordable housing is housing in, housing in good condition that can typically be rented or purchased without households paying more than 30% of gross income, or fair market rents. But in Savannah, about 45% of the renters are cost-burdened, spending over 30% of their income in housing. Therefore, the city is facing a significant affordable housing deficiency. And these findings are not recent. They've been there. The problem has been there since early as 2021. And Housing Savannah Action Plan has highlighted these strategies to be included in our ordinances so that we can find a solution for affordable housing. They are define affordable housing in the city code, provide flexibility in affordable housing development standards, including in PD districts, provide bonus or incentives for affordable housing, allow increased density and dwelling units per lot parcel, allow smaller, narrower lot widths and lot areas, allow smaller building setbacks, allow larger lot coverage for buildings, reduce off-street parking requirements, encourage development of missing middle housing, provide incentives for small growth, mixed use, transit-oriented, and walkable development. However, the zoning ordinance currently does not really address these requirements to the full extent. With the proposed text amendment, the applicant proposes revisions to the ordinance that would permit variances to incentivizing high densities, tight versions, accommodated affordable housing in selected traditional zoning districts. And this proposal is also complementing a density bonus program for affordable housing, which is currently under the proposal stage, and it is led by the Community Housing Services Agency, Savannah Affordable Housing Fund, and the City of Savannah. This program, while not codified within the text of the zoning ordinance, is a necessary companion to the effectively tie the financial components of the strategies with contextual development standards to ensure the compatibility of a proposed development with the character of the receiving neighborhoods. And this is the geography that is affected by this text amendment. It includes all the traditional zoning districts. The staff has found that the presented amendment was conceived in an effort to avoid misuse the ordinance's provisions for variance relief from development standards granted by the MPC and ZBA. The need for affordable housing is a recognized priority of the jurisdiction, and codification of the proposed modified development standards reflect the acknowledged public benefit, which ultimately drives the relaxation of development standards where there is an intent to provide community affordable housing within the scope and meaning of the density bonus program. At present, the zoning ordinance inadequately accommodates the development of affordable housing typologies and lacks incentives for developers to prioritize affordability. The present text amendment aimed to relax relevant development standards for explicit allowance of affordable housing creation through thoughtfully targeted provisions. The proposed text still does not include a clear definition of affordable housing, nor does the city's code of ordinances provide one. This omission can lead to ambiguity regarding the developments qualify as affordable housing through the density bonus program. The proposal also does not define a specific period of affordability or establish a minimum time period for which the incentivized units must be accommodated for affordability. If structures built under the density bonus allowance are not deed restricted for affordability, it may result in contradictions between development standards and use standards. The proposed text lacks a defined method of monitoring ongoing compliance with the affordable housing designation. Therefore, the MPC staff recommends that forthcoming refinements of the program make inclusion of these elements a top priority. While a portion of the impacted property situated within the protected local historic district, which ensures a COA, is required for a new construction, 61% of the affected properties lie outside the districts. Without further amendment, over 628 acres currently zoned for traditional development currently lacks protection against potential incompatible development. In the absence of an infill development overlay or other limiting mechanism, the proposed changes to the traditional districts could lead a MUP amendment request in areas not initially anticipated and potentially resulting in unanticipated developments. Although many impacted zoning districts align with the specific designated historic district, the TC1 and TC2 districts are not confined to a specific geographical area of the city, raising concerns about housing proposal in outlying regions that may not be prepared to receive them. Zoning districts are designated to promote orderly and patterned development with means such as maximum permanent density, setback standards, and maximum lot coverage established to create a comfortable and hygienic built environment. Without contextual guidelines for introducing new housing typologies and forms, as well as standards to limit the height and bulk of new development adjacent to smaller, less dense residential areas, the proposal risks altering the character of well-established neighborhoods. A pre-approved plan book or design manual featuring missing organic locally grown housing types could help mitigate this risk. In relationship between the standards guiding development of residential structures and specific demographic groups, they are intended to support cannot be overlooked or understated. It is vital to create occupancy standards in relation to the proposed policies, which will ensure clarity and alignment in the proposed text so that such incentivized housing development is effectively tailored to meet the need of Savannah's diverse community. With that, the MPC staff recommends approval of the proposed text amendment with the following condition. The following four updated programmatic elements shall be presented to the Planning Commission by the Development Department of Planning and Urban Design within 180 days of the date of City Council adoption in support of this competent future disposition of the request for special exception persons to propose text amendments. One, a definition of affordable housing. Two, a defined period of affordability. Three, nomination of an ombudsman and a documented explanation of the intended mechanism for ongoing compliance monitoring. Four, delineation and establishment of an infill development boundary to prevent adverse rezoning and development in locations lacking adequate infrastructure. MPC staff also recommends creation of following programmatic elements for future refinement of the density bonus program. Contextual guidelines for missing middle housing typologies such as pre-approved plan book or design manual, occupancy standards to ensure incentivized housing developments and effectively tailored to meet the need of Savannah's diverse community. Thank you.
Thank you. Is the applicant here?
Afternoon.
Thank you.
I'm Bridget Liddy with the City's Planning and Urban Design Department. I wanted to thank you all for allowing us to be here today, and this has been a momentous task pulling this together. We actually presented this back to you in March of this year with some concepts and ideas, and we've been actively working with our partners here at MPC as well as Brianna Paxton to try to address an issue in the ordinance that we have right now that prohibits a variance to lot area when you're increasing density. And that's really the main reason why we're here. We're looking at this as an incremental process where we're going to start small and gradually build off of it. I think someone in the pre-meeting, Chairwoman, I think you used steps. That's where we're going with this. So I'm going to be quiet and let the people who have done a lot of the work on this get up and have them speak about it and highlight their efforts. So Brianna Paxton and John, you want to come on up?
Thank you. Please just state your name for the record.
Hi, my name is Brianna Paxton. I'm here in partnership with the City of Savannah and MPC staff for this text amendment. I just want to point out this has been a very collaborative effort with MPC staff and the city staff. Me as a private citizen, you know, anyone can apply for a text amendment in the City of Savannah. And once we all got around the table and started talking, we're able to have some hard conversations sometimes. We are very happy with the product that we came out with. It's much stronger than I think anyone initially anticipated. On the screen is my daughter helping me visit a house that my friend was building that was a land bank property that was built and then sold to a low-income home buyer. And building a property for my daughter is the reason that I'm here. Let me make this go slide. One of the problems that we have and the reason I'm here today is because I was trying to build a duplex on a 30-foot-wide lot in the Live Oak neighborhood. That's TR2 zoning, and that is illegal per our zoning. One of the reasons it's illegal is because we define density in the City of Savannah as minimum lot area per unit. Other municipalities might define it as floor area ratio or some other concept, but we use this minimum lot area per unit. And so when you, as an applicant, can't meet that, you can't build that development because we also prohibit variances on minimum lot area per unit. So we prohibit it density variances, if you will. So we, so I've been under contract with the land bank since last June. There's another applicant, Brad Ball, who's a local developer who has five properties under contract with the land bank, same situation. I'm also aware of another, local nonprofit developer that wants to build a duplex, same situation. They want to do affordable housing, do two units instead of one, and it's currently illegal. So we're trying to fix this varying density problem in a very managed way. This varying, can't vary density problem is allowed us, to be in a situation where we can't rebuild missing middle housing, duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes that exist in many areas of Savannah. The lot that I'm trying to build on in Live Oak, there are seven existing duplexes up and down that block. So I stand in that lot and look around. Anyone scratching their head realizes that this should be legal. So how do we make it legal? Another reason is that we all know there are many households today that cannot find housing in Savannah that they can afford, which as Sabashi presented earlier, is generally considered when a household is spending 30% of their income or less on housing costs. So households in Savannah that make around $50,000 or less a year really struggle to find housing. I'm one of those households for all transparency. So me building a duplex and being able to rent out the other side to afford my mortgage is my best chance at home ownership. I also want to talk about home ownership and property ownership is recognized as one of the number way people that build. It's one of the number one ways that people build wealth. In 2021, the Savannah Racial Justice Task Force found that 30% of households of color in Savannah have a net worth of zero. So I ask you to take that into consideration that we are trying to use this text amendment to allow us to increase opportunities for housing and home ownership and in turn decrease inequities. When we started researching why it was illegal to build duplexes, how many duplexes are there, this is the map that was created. This is using data from our tax assessor. And so these dots that you see on the screen are all properties where the residential property type is not single family, but it's something more than single family. I couldn't tell you how many units of housing are on those properties, but we know there's more than one unit of housing. So there's almost 1,700 properties in the TC, TN, and TR districts that already exhibit this missing middle housing type that we are trying to recreate. But we also tried to come at this from a different avenue. So the City of Savannah Revenue Department was able to provide us data on the number of water meters per property. Same situation. About half have 1 meter. The other half have more than 1 meter. So we know that these are areas of town where missing middle housing and small scale multifamily already exist. Here are some examples of that type of housing. On the top is a attached duplex in Kyler Brownville that's illegal to rebuild. The gray fourplex in the middle is one of my favorite properties. That's in Midtown, just east of Perk Coffee. The yellow on the top is a duplex in Thomas Square. And the bottom is brown side-by-side. The duplex with a great porch is over in Carver Heights. All of these properties today are illegal to build because of our restrictions on density. So now that you know the types of housing that we're trying to allow to be able to rebuild, I want to talk about the why now. Why don't we have all the details on the programmatic side figured out? It's because people are anxious for action. And I want to illustrate this data, which comes to us by way of Savannah resident Emma Cavello, who volunteered her time to pull this census data and illustrate it in this great manner. So at the top of the screen, the area median income for all households in Savannah is $56,000. The median sales price from Redfin for 2024 is $324,000. That leaves a gap of $140,000 where the median family cannot afford the median sales price. When we jump over in the middle is median households where families with children. So if you're a married couple with children, you have a little bit more of the area median income, but if you're a single female head of household, $240,000 gap. That is an uphill battle to find a place to live or a home to own in the city of Savannah. And when we jump to the renter side, the median rent cost in Savannah is around $1,700 right now, but the median renter can afford $1,200 a month. So again, there's about a $500 gap in affordability. And to really hit these points home, I also want to talk about our housing inventory gap. On the left-hand side today, left-hand side is the rent burden map. So households are typically said to be rent burdened when they're spending more than 30% of their income on housing. So you can see property households that make less than $20,000 a year or less than $50,000 a year, they're spending upwards of more than 50% of their income on housing. I also want to talk on the right-hand side of your screen are a couple of more census factoids. Savannah's household size has been trending down. We have about 40% of households are single-person households. There's also another good chunk of households that are four or more persons, conceivably those families with children that we just saw on the other slide. But what types of housing units do we have to offer in Savannah? Over 50% of our housing units are single-family detached homes with three bedrooms. So we are trying to have a mismatch of single-person households living in properties that are larger than they might need and not enough housing for the properties for other families that do need housing of smaller scale. So that is one of the main reasons that's really driving home this text amendment for me, that it needs to offer a density bonus for affordable housing and only if we're providing affordable housing, because these are the families that we're trying to help. Emma also pulled for me a profile on local workers. So as you can see, just based off the average salaries for a teacher, construction worker, a server, janitorial staff, administrative assistant, these are the folks that keep our community running. They cannot afford housing in the city of Savannah. I know this is very high level and there are a lot of intricacies involved with this data, but I hope this paints a picture as to why we need a density bonus for affordable housing that allows us to build smaller, but doesn't necessarily mean giant apartment buildings. Jumping to a high level of what this text amendment does, because I know not everyone loves to read zoning code. It applies to TC, TN, and TR neighborhoods, which is about 8,000 parcels. These areas were chosen because they are close to downtown, close to transit, and they are areas where missing middle housing already exists. This is would be considered smart growth infill. As Savashi already explained, we expand the type of residential housing types allowed for those missing middle types. So you could build 2 to 4 unit properties in these districts, as is already allowed. And we also are allowing this by right, that for TR1 and TR2, you could do up to 4 units. And in TR3, you could do up a duplex when you meet affordable housing standards and you meet alternative development standards, which are outlined in the text. We also added, if you are trying to do more than 4 units, then you must come before this board through a special exception hearing process. And we added a new special exception. You know, we have a list of existing 12 special exceptions. Now we have a 13th, that would apply only when someone is seeking a density bonus for affordable housing. And we also added new review criteria for you all to consider when you have one of those proposals, which includes questions like, what is the public benefit of this project? We also add some clarifying language for parking, for when there is no lane and there's no street, where do you put that required parking space? In those limited situations, we would ask for a larger front yard setback. Again, here are the applicable zones to this district. Most of, in the zoning code, most of these districts, TR in particular, are tied to the neighborhoods themselves. So there's not a risk of someone being able to rezone a property in Windsor Forest to be TR2 because it's not in that neighborhood. So by and large, these are the districts and the areas of town where this program could be used. Over the last 2 months, I have been on a journey talking to every neighborhood association and group that cares about housing, as many as I can. And I was able to attend many neighborhood association meetings, and this is the type of information that I presented to them. I wanted people to understand that a fourplex could be built next to a single family house, and if there's going to be affordable housing involved with that. And if that sounds scary, then tell me that so we can implement your feedback into this proposal. I also want to point out we've been trying to talk about the types of information that's going in the zoning ordinance versus the type of information that will be added in programmatic elements and enforced by the city of Savannah. And many of the comments that I heard from neighborhoods, Kyler Brownville wants homeownership prioritized. That can be implemented in those city guidelines. Other people said that they thought this didn't do enough. Why don't we just allow density everywhere? Well, again, I point back to those people that can't find housing, and we need to provide housing for them first. And maybe down the line, we start loosening again and allowing more density. But I think part of this density bonus is how do we get more affordable housing units brought online the fastest? So I am happy to present that we have many supporting organizations and individuals who are involved with housing in Savannah. I also had conversations with Carver Village, Kyler Brownville, and Thomas Square neighborhoods that wasn't able to get a letter of support from in just because of the timing, I would say, but I'm trying to keep all the neighborhoods informed and take their feedback as we're moving forward, because this is very much a collaborative effort. And I'm going to turn it over to John.
All right, I'm John Antignos. I work in the Planning and Urban Design Department at the City of Savannah. I'm going to walk through a little bit of how this would technically work in the zoning ordinance. And so the first thing we'll talk about is how, if an applicant currently wants to request modification to zoning standards for housing, how do they do that? And then how would this amendment change those processes? So, and then we'll talk about the specific changes. So currently there's two basic processes for requesting modification to zoning standards, a variance or a special exception. A variance has pretty broad leeway to modify standards significantly, but does have more stringent review criteria that are applied by the Zoning Board of Appeals, and in some cases by the Planning Commission or the Historic District Board of Review. Special exceptions have a little bit looser review criteria, but are much more narrowly defined. So there's only certain things that can be done through a special exception. And so that's kind of the trade-off between those two things. But in essence, they accomplish the same thing, which is an applicant can say, I am unable to meet a particular zoning standard, and I would like for it to be modified in some way. One of the key things that Brianna mentioned is that in the zoning ordinance, there are specific standards that may not be varied. Even if you ask for permission from the Zoning Board of Appeals or the Planning Commission, they do not have the authority. This board does not have the authority to make variances to certain things. And so one of those things is lot area per unit. The other thing that you should note is that allowed housing types also may not be varied through a variance or a special exception currently. And that's what this proposal would change as one element of it. So backing up a little bit, this proposed amendment would also allow a staff-approved modification process. So that would not require going to the Zoning Board of Appeals, would not require coming to this board. It would allow a staff person to review a development application and approve it with no public noticed review if it meets certain criteria. And so that's what we're calling here the by right option. And the key with the by right option is that the changes that are allowed are minor and they are discreetly defined. They are numerically defined as specific changes, which I will show to you, to the typical zoning standards for residential development, and they are meant to be objective. So if there's ever any question, how was this approved? The staff person can specifically point to the standard, the numeric standard, and say, here's how the proposed development met that specific standard. Alternatively, the special exception process says, if you want to have a bigger modification than what's allowed by the by right standard, you would have to go to the Planning Commission and you would have to explain your concept. You would have to show what you're planning to develop and give justification for why that larger modification should be allowed. And then this board would have the ability to weigh the merits of that proposal and make a decision. And the key thing with both of those is that the Housing Services Department at the City of Savannah has to have already looked at what the developer is proposing and agreed that it is going to provide affordable housing units in the number and the type that the Housing Services Department can approve. So what does that mean? And this is where we're breaking away from zoning and we're getting into departmental policy at the city. And so zoning is not the only means that the city can apply its policy goals. There's many departments that have policies that fall outside the world of zoning and also fall outside the world of the code of ordinances. They can just be policies adopted by departments. And so that's what's being proposed here, is that the process and the by right modifications would live in the zoning ordinance, but the specific definition of what constitutes affordable housing for this purpose would live in policy documents that are maintained by the Housing Services Department and would be accountable to the city manager and the city council through that department, not through enforcement of zoning regulations. And so what the Housing Services Department is drafting and plans to have available for this process is guidelines that would provide a time period of affordability, the level of affordability for different household incomes, the number of affordable units that would be required, the maximum site area. And so the number that we've discussed so far is a maximum site size of 10,000 square feet, which is about a quarter of an acre. And so that would be, again, to ensure that this type of density bonus or increase in the number of housing units would be oriented towards small infill lots. So this is not intended to be, you know, multiple acre apartment developments. Neighborhood design standards, so ensuring aesthetic compatibility or architectural compatibility with the existing neighborhoods. And then how do we ensure that the developer and subsequent property owners are providing those units at an affordable level for the entire time period? So all those things can and will be established by the Housing Services Department and are not going to be inserted into the zoning ordinance. And one of the key purposes of that is, as we heard in the staff presentation, things change over time in terms of the types of housing units that we'd like to have be affordable, the type of incomes that we would like to prioritize, household income levels. And so by placing those guidelines into policies that are managed by the Housing Services Department, they can be more nimble and flexible to respond to those changing market conditions and changing needs of low and medium income households, rather than having to change the zoning ordinance every time something like that changes. All right, so getting into more specifics about the actual zoning standards. So this is the by right option. And so this is where an applicant would go to the Housing Services Department. They would say, I have a plan for, let's say, a triplex. One of those units would be affordable, and I have this lot where I'd like to build it. The Housing Services Department says, we think that meets our standards, and so we'll give you the go-ahead to then apply for this development permit. Then city staff would review their development permit, and if it has this restricted set of reductions to the typical zoning standards, so reducing the lot width per unit by 5 feet, for example, increasing building coverage by no more than 10 percentage points, they would be allowed to build that triplex when ordinarily they would only be allowed potentially to build a duplex. They would be able to get an additional unit out of that lot and not have to go in front of a board like this, but only if it's within this narrowly defined set of modifications. The other option is maybe they want a fourplex on that same lot, and that fourplex cannot be achieved with this specific set of modifications. They need larger modifications. They will come to you and say, I think I can do a fourplex, provide this number of affordable units as provided for by the housing or the Neighborhood Housing Services Department, and I think I can achieve this development concept on this lot. You review that, and you decide whether you think that project should be approved. All right, so here's an example of an existing house, a duplex, that could not be built under current standards. But if someone came in and wanted to build this again, they could using that by right option. They would be allowed to have a reduction in the lot width per unit and a reduction in lot area per unit. And this could be approved if this, you know, this duplex was no longer there and someone wanted to build something brand new that was just like this. They could approach Housing Services, say, I'm going to have one of these units be affordable. Housing Services could sign off on that and then get this approved by staff if this text amendment is approved. Here's another example, again, a duplex. And so, again, this could be the buy right option. So building this, again, this is something that already exists, but is no longer legal. And so what this text amendment is saying is you could build things again that we did once build, you know, 70, 80, 90 years ago. You just have to provide an affordable unit. And then this third example is would not be allowed with the buy right option, with the staff approval option. It would require a greater deviation from the typical zoning standard, but could be approved by this board if you thought this project made sense. And again, this is something that already exists, already is fitting in with a neighborhood and already is serving four households currently, but you can't build this again today. And so that's the basic goal here, is to provide a pathway in two different ways, either by right with minor modifications or with larger modifications through a special exception through this planning commission, in either case requiring previous approval by the Housing Services Department that the affordable housing standards would be met and that that would allow additional development of affordable units, additional total housing supply, and allow greater use of existing lots and existing neighborhoods in Savannah. So, thank you.
All right. Are there any questions for staff or the applicant? Go ahead, Ms. Amy.
I'm just curious, when did they stop allowing those homes you just showed us to be built, and who made that decision and why did they make that decision?
So I think in a lot of cases that happened with the original application of zoning in 1960. So zoning didn't exist in Savannah prior to 1960. And that, you know, that was our very first zoning ordinance and that went all the way up to NUZO in 2019. And so yeah, what happened was a lot of neighborhoods had zoning districts applied that limited the housing types. And then NUZO did that kind of again in some places. So there were some neighborhood zoning districts that changed that further restricted the housing types, but the original application in 1960 of a zoning ordinance is probably when that happened in most places.
But I still don't understand why it happened. What was the purpose of that?
All right, let's take a deep dive into the history of zoning. So zoning originally was upheld by the United States Supreme Court in the late 1920s and started to become popular in the United States in the 1930s and 40s. And really hit the big time after World War II. And so, you know, originally some of the thought process around zoning was you should separate uses that are wholly incompatible with each other. Like a coal-fired power plant should not be next to a neighborhood, right? That's commonsensical, seems obvious to anyone. But very quickly after zoning was invented, it began to be used to segregate people economically and by the same token, racially. And so I think, you know, in a lot of cities after World War II, that was a motivation for applying zoning was, and you know, some of it was based on, and this is actually, the Supreme Court heard this argument and agreed with it in the majority opinion that multifamily development is more likely to be people of, low moral character. And I think that's something that is a legacy of zoning, that we're still living with and we need to recognize and respond to.
If I may, just the simple answer to your question basically is that when ordinances, in addition to what John eloquently explained, was put into place, you had a lot also more people concerned about incompatible land uses. And that's also when some of the planning documents from the standpoint of master plans, comprehensive plans, those discussions took place. So you had some areas where you had really teeny lots that were not compatible with some of the adjacent uses. So in a lot of cases, they just kind of did averaging. They didn't like tell people that they had to tear the houses down that were not compatible, but they became nonconforming uses. The goal of the nonconforming use is that it would go away once the life cycle of the property went away. In Savannah, that didn't happen. A lot of the homes remained in place. They were allowed to do upkeep on those houses that exceeded the tax value. In other communities, if your house is valued, if your value is less than 50%, you can do maintenance. If you do more than 50%, you have to bring the whole thing up to standards. Well, people just kept bringing it up a little bit, but people kept building around them as well. And each time the zoning ordinance got updated, you had different land uses that took place. And a lot of that, as we moved on, took place with the community being involved as well. Right up to NUZO, when there was a very detailed land use analysis that took place where staff went out, looked at all the adjacent properties, and in some cases, there was some averaging that said this is the appropriate size based on what the development pattern is, and you still had some nonconforming lot sizes, and that was okay because of the way that the city has chosen to deal with nonconforming conditions. So, you know, there is nothing, and each city is different. I just wanted to be clear about that. Each community is different with regards to how they handle situations like that. But nothing stays the same that was done in the 1960s, 1950s. You always have this change. It's a living process based on development trends.
I have another question. The by right. So if I own a home and somebody buys the lot next door and wants to build, and I know there's size variations and all, but they want to build, just say, a duplex. And a staffer approves it, and I have no notification, no objection, no ability to say anything. It just is going to happen.
Yeah, that's correct. And in most of these zoning districts, duplexes are already permitted by right, just on in a slightly larger lot size.
Sure, the lot size. That's the big difference.
That's one of the main things that we looked at is the by right option. Is meant to reflect housing types that you could already expect to be in a neighborhood.
But you're allowing the lot to be reduced by 50%.
Yeah, I understand that the 50% minimum lot area per unit reduction seems generous. I think the practical nature of it is that most lots are not really going to be able to make use of that because there are real world constraints. They're still going to have to meet setbacks. They're still going to have to provide parking. And also, you know, the unit still has to accommodate a certain number of bedrooms and a bathroom and corridors. So, you know, there's only so much you can shrink a lot area per unit before it just becomes physically impossible to build a house. So there's a floor that's a practical floor. And so I think the thought process is as long as the lot coverage and the setbacks are marginal increments for what the current standard is, you're going to have a similar building envelope. And then the number of units that's in that building is less important than the actual scale of the building on the lot.
Is it possible to build a fourplex with half a driveway?
No, we have specific driveway standards. So driveways have to be a minimum width and depth. So
it said something in there about half a parking space.
Right, half a parking space per unit. So there's a provision in the zoning ordinance where we have a rounding process. So if you have a half a unit, it rounds up. Or if you have a half a parking space, it rounds up to a whole parking space. So basically what that would do is say, if you have a duplex, you only have to provide one parking space. Fourplex, you only have to provide two. If you had a triplex, you're still going to have to provide two parking spaces.
So in areas where the lots are generally a little smaller already, there's going to be more parking on the street.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think one of the thought processes is that by their geography, these neighborhoods are well suited to not using private vehicles. So most of these neighborhoods, in fact, as far as I know, all of them have access to public transit. And a lot of them also have a mix of uses where it's not terribly difficult to walk or bicycle to a store, a grocery store, a restaurant, you know, local amenities that you might want to use. And that is one of the reasons why this type of development pattern is most appropriate in these types of neighborhoods. Yeah, I think there are places in Savannah and the wider area where it would be unreasonable to expect that only half of housing units are going to have a vehicle. The other thing that's helpful to think about is that, you know, at least one of the units is going to be for a household meeting a low income requirement. And so low income households are also statistically likely to own fewer vehicles per household, more likely to use public transit. And I'll note that, you know, federal guidelines for affordable housing specify lower parking requirements than you would typically find for bank financing. So when a bank finances a multifamily development, they are going to look for something like 2 parking spaces per unit. Whereas when you have federal programs that are funding affordable housing units, they will look for closer to 1 parking space per unit because of the acknowledgement that lower income households are more likely to use non-private vehicle transportation.
I also just wanted to clarify that the By Right Avenue, the property has to have access, vehicle access from a lane.
John.
Wait a minute. Mr. Plunk was next. Sorry.
Thank you. I know that that John and Bridget and Bree and Melanie and a lot of people have all kind of been involved in this for months now, trying to come to the table. And I know that that can be hard when you've got a lot of different groups and people with different perspectives and ideas and, you know, wants of what they get out. So I applaud you all for coming up with something here today, because I know it's been quite a work in progress for a while now. One of the things that stands out to me is, you know, a lot of this kind of seems like a bit of a band-aid solution that you're all trying to address the ban on density increase when increasing lot area because of our definition of density by minimum lot area by unit. I mean, that kind of is what this all goes back to. Was there any thought to just addressing that outright? I mean, if that's the big issue, a lot of this seems to be kind of going in a roundabout way to get around that. Why not just, you know, go after that directly? I mean, some of this, I mean, it's not super complicated, but it seems in some ways more complicated than it needs to be. And I know a lot of people said, you know, this is kind of a first step. And I personally would love to see further upzoning, you know, in all the communities around the city. So I understand if this is, you know, we're taking baby steps here, but was there thought given to that? Is that something that can be done at all? If that's the real problem, the root of the problem, and I imagine that can be addressed by a text amendment as well, you know, What was discussed, you know, when coming up with this that kind of produced this? Whoever wants to take that, or all or the above.
Yeah, I think the real purpose of this is to provide more units of affordable housing. And so that's why we're limiting it density bonus if and only if you're providing affordable housing. I think that the communities that do have density bonuses for other public benefit reasons, I mean, that's their prerogative. But as we've seen in Savannah, our most acute need right now is affordable housing. So that's where it's kind of like, how do we force, you know, the only avenue to use this program is to provide affordable housing. That's the way I approached it.
Yes. I was just going to say, if you want to go ahead, you're probably going to say what I was going to say.
I say, so you and I have a relationship from the ZBA.
Yeah.
I didn't catch the entire question, but from what I understood, it sounded like you were saying, why was this not addressed directly, as in to actually permit variances to lot area and density, right, and things of that, right, nature? So again, this is that misuse. This is really about misuse of a tool that is there under circumstance of hardship. And the reason why this needed to come to this board as opposed to, say, the ZBA. So that route is there for a particular set of concerns. This is not really that. Those things don't represent hardships. The one thing that the zoning ordinance that is a great tool is that it gives you the right to build a single-family home on a parcel that is zoned for residential use. And so the things that constitute a hardship then are significantly lessened. It's one thing when you come in and you're talking about setbacks. It's different when you say, well, hey, I want to build multiple units. And so the idea is we don't want to kind of sort of misuse, misuse the variance route because the criteria is hardship. We are attempting to address something for a particular public benefit. There's an urgent public need. And so the idea is that we are going to set, as John just very eloquently stated, there's a floor. There's a functional floor that, you know, is our engineering standards, our building standards. And we're sort of reducing or relaxing those requirements for the purpose of allowing affordable housing in particular, not just for general, hey, I overpaid for this lot.
I now need some variance relief because I have a financial hardship, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
I was just going to say the other thing too, if you look at what the staff recommendation is, that's why I wanted it pulled up. In our conversations, because we did have robust conversations and it was really kind of a great collaborative effort to talk with, you know, work with Brianna and the city staff on looking at this and housing community development as well. But this is something that hopefully or should be coming back within 180 days to look at these other items that there was some agreement that we would come back. There would be some more discussion on. Moving forward now is to get us started so that people that meet the threshold without having to worry about this can move forward and go ahead and build. Again, I made reference in the pre-meeting that you have several land bank properties that if this were put in place, even if it comes back with these conditions, there could be development that took place to provide some affordability. And Edward is absolutely right. When you think about a hardship and a variance, variances technically are things you're not supposed to create your own hardship. Doesn't matter whether you overpaid for a lot or whatever. You're not supposed to create your own hardship. In this case, this is a public benefit. The public benefit is that we know that we have a housing crisis. Savannah is the ninth most expensive rental market in the country right now. It's really expensive to live here. And this is a way to try to address that need, but yet move forward to, adding some additional criteria so that we can address some of Ms. Amy's concerns regarding the neighbors and things of that nature. It's not a perfect thing, but it's a great start. And that's why our recommendation is that we come back within the 180 days to finish up the other components of it. But we need to have at least the first part of it so that we can at least get some of those other properties that kind of have been sitting developed.
Mr. Wadwoody was next.
Thank you, Estelle.
If I could just clarify the intent behind these, if I'm hearing correctly, the idea here, there was some initial discussion that these were going to be codified elements of this program. That is no longer the intent. We understand that there are some things that need to be flexible. And so the idea is that planning and urban design will come back to this board within 180 days to deliver these policy documents to this board to kind of fully round out your understanding of what the targeted aims of this program are. This is information that this board needs to understand kind of the intent and the impetus behind this program. So these are not requests for additional changes to the text that you're seeing. This is a delivery of elements that you may in fact already be in possession of, but just to bring them kind of from behind that curtain to say, yes, this organization is managing this component. This is how it works, because when these, when you make a decision to allow that four unit structure next to that single family home, something that would have to go before this board, the idea is that we want to be able to provide the public and everyone who may be interested with the actual documents supporting the basis for that decision made by this board. That's kind of the idea behind this request.
And then on top of that, John, I want to see, do you, from the housing department, do y'all have any, issue with, having that turnaround from the housing department within 180 days, any of the stipulations on there? And then if you had anything to add as well from the first question, as far as eventually addressing this kind of as a whole, obviously I know, we want to get this for affordable units from the get-go, right? Turnaround starting tomorrow, but, is there any interest, if we're the ninth most expensive rental market in the United States, we need to be doing more than I think even just building at the affordable level. We need to be looking at increasing density kind of at all levels of the, even the top, middle, has there been thought to kind of coming back and take another bite of the apple down the road?
Yeah, I mean, I think the 180-day timeline seems reasonable. I can't really speak for the Housing Services Department, but I know that they do want to move forward with those guidelines as expeditiously as possible because they very much want that program to be a success and see a lot of opportunity to start producing units under that program.
So the city has no issue with the conditions is that you know of?
I think it is a reasonable goal. I, again, cannot speak to the ability of housing services to meet it, but yes, I think we will definitely attempt to meet that goal. And certainly when that task is completed, it will be reported back to this board. There's no doubt about that. It's just a question of, when will that come together?
Faye DiMaggio basically came up with the 180 days. Okay. So it's not like something that we pulled
coming
out of
from
the
within
air.
The city.
We basically sat down and had a discussion about the time frame that would work with all parties involved.
Right.
So that's what the agreed time frame was.
Go ahead.
And then in terms of, you know, other items to consider in terms of housing production and housing variety, absolutely. I know from the top down, the city of Savannah is very interested in exploring a lot of different tools, and we are in conversation. You know, the city has a task force for advancing affordable housing goals. So, yes, absolutely. I think there's going to be additional items that come forward in the future, and this is a way to get the ball rolling and to start to see some progress. And also, I think, to set an example of how this type of thing can be done in a way that's sensitive and respects and appreciates the wonderful neighborhoods where this is proposed. I mean, I think that's really a part of this conversation, is that this type of housing is part of Savannah's history. It's been a good part of Savannah's history. So I think we can enjoy that going forward.
Go ahead.
So I have a little bit of experience in this whole thing. In 2019, in November, the affordable house, our first time buyer house, was about 150,000. We had about 6 months of supply on the market. Now we have about 3 months supply on the market, and the median price range is about 336. Back in 2019, it was about 220. Fortunately or unfortunately, we've been discovered by the country, and they're all moving here. And that is an issue. One of the reasons we're dealing with an issue of affordability in this area is housing supply. Housing supply is bad in Savannah. It's also bad in the surrounding areas, and that is all a function of density. I don't think that there's anybody, any developer in this market that would come in here and be unhappy that you gave him twice the density that he was asking for. And we are stuck on a 60-foot wide density, and I know that's countywide. But density is a big issue, and that speaks to supply. And I think that ultimately, if we want to attack the affording housing crisis, it starts with what we're doing today, but it also starts with a lot of other places. I could name off the top of my head 10 ways to improve the housing supply that we have red tape and bureaucracy in front of us that prevents us from doing that. And so I guess the question that I have to you is, what are we doing beyond this? Is there any indication from the county at looking at improved densities, infill development, improved, you know, the things we're doing here? Is there a wider gaze across the whole spectrum of housing supply and what our future needs are beyond just the affordability? Because I think ultimately, if you improve the supply overall, you improve the affordability.
Yeah, I think there is a document that captures exactly what you're talking about, which is an affordable housing sort of work plan that was issued. I believe I might need to call a lifeline.
2022.
There was an affordable housing task force, but from the county standpoint, anyway, I can at least say that because I've been in talks with them as well, that they're also looking at this issue. And they have partnered with the city to go after funding to start looking more at housing affordability and things of that nature, which is a big deal for the county because in the past they didn't have a housing conversation at all. I sit on that affordable housing task force at the time. This is something that's really important, I know, to the city. It's also important from discussions that I've had with the county manager and the chair that it's also important in the county as well. The proposals that move forward in the county are not going to be anything as drastic as this from the standpoint of some of the changes, just because they don't have the infrastructure in place. I mean, that's one of the biggest challenges that we've got. That's the elephant in the room, is that you've got to have infrastructure to support. And that's not only water and sewer, but it's also the road network to support intense density. And you also have to have a robust public transit system, which we don't have. I mean, I think we're working toward it, but we don't have that yet. Trust me, the county has been very, very active in having these discussions. I know Laura Lane is here. She's working on a grant in partnership with Tara Jennings to move forward to to get funding to do more public outreach to talk about housing affordability and what it means and things of that nature. So everybody's having this discussion because we, you know, we're having a high affordable housing crisis.
Yeah, thanks.
Mr. Natrika? Mr. Melder?
Thank you. First off, just a huge thank you to Brianna and to John and to Bridget and to all of the MPC staff, Ms. Wilson, and everyone who participated. It was a really, I know, intense collaborative effort. And I think, one, it just kind of is, you know, shows the great community spirit here that a resident brought forward a petition and the authorities, you know, that received it recognized its importance and got together to work together to make sure that that petition didn't go in vain, but it actually was something that could be brought before this body and before City Council, hopefully, to be adopted. I agree with everything that my colleagues have said on the dais here. This is a tool in the toolbox. Mm-hmm. And I think an important one. And just as John, I think, gave us all a really important lesson in the history of zoning and the moral fluidity of public policy, that we can take some steps to improve and repair some of the policies that have been enacted in the past that may have lessened access to critical infrastructure like housing for some people. And I think that in the districts that the team has proposed, it's extraordinarily appropriate for this type of what Laura Lane McKinnon likes to call gentle density. And it's one tool in the toolbox, but we're going to need many more. But hopefully this can be a proof of concept that restoring some historic housing types, just like we've restored many historic homes, is going to prove to be a positive thing for this community, not detract from it at all, but actually build to its vibrancy. So I'm just really thankful for the work of the team who put this together. Thank you.
Thanks.
Any other comments? All right. I didn't see any speaker cards. There's no one online. All right, I guess we are ready for a motion.
Cole's motion to approve staff's recommendation with the included condition.
Second.
Bull, second.
All right. Ms. Amick?
No.
Ms. Bowles?
Yes.
Mr. Coles?
Yes.
Mr. Melder?
Yes.
Ms. Wilson?
No.
Mr. Natrika?
Yes.
Mr. Plunk?
Yes, but let's go further.
Mr. Welch?
Yes.
Mr. Wywoody?
Yes.
I too say yes. Thank you. All right, we have one other agenda item at this point in time, and that is from the nominating committee. Does the nominating committee have a report?
Yes, after talking with the current office holders, it seems like everyone that is in current positions wants to stay on for another term. No one else came forward as wanting to add their name into the mix. And I know at this point we will open up to the floor to see if anybody would like to nominate someone.
Yes, the nominations are open. Does anyone want to nominate someone? All right, that being said, is there an interest or willingness to go ahead and vote?
I believe we need to close nominations.
Close nominations, yes.
So motion, Cole's motion to close nominations.
Jeff Dentrica, second.
All right, motion to move forward with the vote.
I'd like to make a motion that we vote on this current slate.
Blunk, second.
Okay, I will do a, go down the roll. Ms. Amick?
Yes.
Ms. Bowles?
Yes.
Mr. Coles?
Yes.
Mr. Melder?
Yes.
Ms. Wilson?
Yes.
Mr. Natrika?
Yes.
Mr. Plunk?
Yes.
Mr. Welsh?
Yep.
Mr. Wawoody?
Yes.
And I too say yes. We have a new slate, candidates for a next year, officers for next year. And I think that is it for today. Anybody have anything before I ask for a motion? All right, motion.
Cole's motion to adjourn.
Cole's second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Did y'all get the historic preservation training? No? I think Ms. Wilson had some. You sure?